You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar.
The men who signed the U.S. Constitution are well known for their role in history and the importance of the document that contains their names. A person who may not be as well known played an important role in the original document. He's the man who actually wrote or penned the words. Jacob Chalice's name appears nowhere on the Constitution, but he transcribed the original Constitution. Cindy Dugalecki is a playwright and distant relative of Jacob Chalice. Dugalecki wrote The Hand That Holds the Quill, a play, as a way to honor her relative's role in history. An all-female production team brings this story to the Capitol Blue Cross Theater at Central Penn College this week. We're joined by playwright Cindy Dugalecki and Chris Purcell, who composed the music. Welcome to the program. Cindy, let me start with you. Tell me about Jacob Chalice. Who was Jacob Chalice?
He was very much a patriot. He fought in the Revolutionary War. He was also the son of a German immigrant. His father came from Germany in 1749. Jacob was born a year later. But his father instilled in him patriotism here in the United States. He served in the Revolutionary War, and he owned a tavern, but he was also an assistant clerk in the Pennsylvania Assembly. So he was around political figures.
So Jacob Chalice is your first cousin six times removed.
Yes.
You learned about him, though, from an Arthur Plotnick book, The Man Behind the Quill. How did that book lead you to Jacob?
Well, I heard about Jacob at a family reunion in 2005. A cousin told me that there was this book written about Jacob, and I went home, immediately ordered it on eBay or Amazon, and read it, put it on a bookshelf, very proud. And then fast forward to 2018, things were very political in our country. And I had gone to a playwrights conference in New York City. And part of the conference enabled conferees to attend a performance of Hamilton. And so I was inspired by a play, a musical about a political figure, political time. And I came home and I reread Arthur Plotnick's book. And something I had never done before, I went online, I found him on, found his website, and I contacted him. And I asked whether or not he would be open to my buying the dramatic rights to his book. In the book, he had, at the time he wrote the book in the 1980s, he was working for the Library of Congress, and he had access to documents and research that I as a playwright would never have had. So he had a lot of photocopies of correspondence that Jacob Chalice did as a quartermaster in the army, one letter to John Hancock. So Art was very receptive to my buying the dramatic rights. We contacted his agent. He contacted his agent. His agent was not as enthusiastic, evidently. So Art and I hammered out a contract on our own, and the rest is history.
So to speak. Yes. So, Jacob Chalice, what did he actually do for the Constitution or in relationship to the Constitution?
Well, as clerk in the Pennsylvania Assembly, he would have known or been in the company of somebody like Ben Franklin, who was president of the Commonwealth at that time. His job was, he was given like 40 hours to write, to engross the Constitution. He was paid $30 for the effort. I have no idea if he knew the enormity of that task, of that political ask that he was employed to do. He was used to writing political documents. In the play, I have him very much aware of the enormity of the decisions the delegates made while they debated the articles in the Constitution.
So when we see a copy of the original Constitution, is that Jacob's handwriting?
Yes.
It is?
Yes. Now, the preamble in the book, Art said, and there's documentation, evidently there was research done on the handwriting. There's a handwriting analysis. And the preamble is actually done by a different person than the body of the Constitution. The body of the Constitution is definitely Jacobs. And Mr. Plotnick, Art made a speculation as to maybe the preamble was actually written, engrossed by his son, who was accomplished also in the art of calligraphy. I made a different choice, but people have to come to the play to see that choice.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the play. This goes in a little bit of a different direction than what many would expect when you're talking about the 1780s. What made you decide to take the hand that holds the quill in that direction and add an extra dimension by focusing on the roles played by women in the events of that time period and also issues of abolition and literacy for the Black community?
When I began my research, it became very clear that the play could end up looking like the musical 1776. It had many of the same players. They were debating in the very same building, in the very same space as the space in which the Declaration of Independence was conceived. So I had to make a distinguishment in some way. And by chance, luck, coincidence, I was having coffee with a friend, and she was telling me about a book that she had read called Founding Mothers by the late Cookie Roberts. And I thought, I got the book, and in that book, there was one line where Cookie said that some of the delegates brought their wives to Philadelphia. And the light bulb went off. I thought, okay, this is my ticket, that I could have Molly Morris, who is Robert Morris's wife, and she was well known as a hostess, a fantastic hostess with class in Philadelphia, Robert Morris being one of the richest men in America. So I had her inviting the wives who were from out of town to her home for tea. And they ended up debating many of the issues that the delegates were debating in the Independence Hall, what is now known as Independence Hall. The delegates are still very much a part of it. They've become a chorus, and Chris has written some wonderful music for them throughout the play, but they're not center stage. So I have the women in there, but also in the course of my research, I came across Absalom Jones, who is the founder of the AME Church. And his story was quite inspiring as an African-American, a free African. Absalom never used the term slave or free slave. He always referred to himself as a free African. And the story with him goes that he was in church. Because of him and his preaching, the numbers of Black congregants had increased, and the church decided to build a gallery to accommodate all these added people coming to their services. And one day in April, Absalom is in the sanctuary of the church. He's kneeling at a prayer rail, and the white people in the church pull him up from his knees and order him to go to the gallery where the other Blacks were worshiping. And Absalom at that moment marched. He and the Black people went with him. They marched out of the church, and they decided to create their own church for their own Black community. And no white person was going to tell them how to worship. So his story, that happened in April of 1787. So that became very crucial to my story too. And I did a lot of probably artistic license, but I think that it rings true in my mind. It rings true that he would be advocating for the right to for Black people to learn how to read and write, which is true historically. So yes, the Blacks and the women, unheard voices at that time, became a very crucial part of the play.
Our guest is playwright Cindy Dugalecki, who wrote The Hand That Holds the Quill, a play about an ancestor who transcribed the U.S. Constitution. We're talking with Chris Purcell, who composed the music, in just a few minutes. Cindy, did it occur to you immediately that you wanted to turn this story into a musical, or is that something that evolved at a later stage?
It wasn't immediate, but when I started writing The Delegates, I definitely heard music. I thought, this could be very dry. And I thought, I need a Chris. I need a Chris to liven it up. And she certainly did. There's one song that she wrote. It's called Toast. It's a toast to Philadelphia. There's also a play on words where the delegates are saying, if they don't get this job done, they're going to be toast in Philadelphia. And Chris took, you know, she took the lyrics of that song, and she had the delegates in a kick line at the end of it. And not knowing that whenever we went to create our production team, the director's mother was a Rockette. So Mary Ann Krahulik came in and coached the delegates on how to do a proper Rockette kick line.
Well, I can just picture Ben Franklin and all the other delegates doing that. Let's listen. Chris Purcell, you worked with Cindy on another collaboration, Into the Desert, but working with Cindy again on this, what was different? What were you looking to do?
Well, Cindy, she told me the story about Jacob Shallis being her relative six times removed, and he was the man that penned the Constitution. I was definitely in 100%. Who has that, right? And I just thought the story was incredibly unusual and unique. And Cindy's writing, she gave me the script to read, and I just thought it was amazing. And I love the fact that she went to the behind the scenes people who are behind the delegates and the things going on there in history. And we have all the other 1776 and all the stories about the Constitution, but I don't think anyone's really written about a play and with music about the women in their lives. Cause you know, when men go to sleep at night, who do they talk to? Their wives, their children, their relatives. So those are the support systems. So she brought all those people into the story and the other fringe people who were there with the African-American people. And Cindy and I both have this thing about our collaborations that, and we really have an agreement on this, is that there's always a profound message underpinning her writings, and in which I capture in music. And that's one of human rights and human dignity and human justice. And even though it's not going to be blaring in your face, there's a message underpinning. And I think justice is one of the most prominent, in my opinion. So, yeah, so she gives me her lyrics, Scott, and she's very profound in her writing. So I often have to edit things. And then I craft the song around, her words and her message. And I always ask her, Cindy, what do you want? What emotion do you want to evoke in this scene? And what do you want the audience to feel when they're viewing this and listening to this? What do you want to capture? And so she tells me that, and then I just take it and run with it. And then I have to edit. It's just like, when you write music, you're crafting a song. So you write a melody and you have to craft out the lyrics and like make them match the melody and the rhythms and things like that. So I do all that. And then I run it past her. And then if I have some amazing idea, which, I'm in this room, this is where the magic happens, right here in my music studio. I run it past her and, like the kick line, I heard the kick line. It just said, I got this idea, Cindy, and I call her and she goes, oh, I love it. I love it. I have chills. And then I go, okay, I'm on the right path here.
Well, chills is a good thing when you're, what you're composing. Hey, Cindy, we only have a minute or so left. You're from Mechanicsburg. You should have mentioned that very early on. The Hand That Holds the Quill will have its premiere performance at the Capitol Blue Cross Theater at Central Penn College on September 16th. That's Thursday, 17th and 19th. And you also will have the play performed in Philadelphia in the future. So tell us about that. Other takeaways that you're looking for and the significance of doing it in Philadelphia. And I have to warn you, I have about a minute left.
My idea about doing it in Philadelphia is to attract maybe the artistic directors of various theaters, to attract the attention of Philadelphia theater people, because the play belongs in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the star of the show. Let's be honest. Philadelphia is the star of the show. There are so many references to Old City Philadelphia, and I've also tucked in some relatively new references to Philadelphia in there that I hope are appreciated by the audience. But Philadelphia is the star, so I'm hoping Philadelphia theaters pick it up, and then if they so choose, they can share it with Broadway. They have my full approval for that.
Playwright Cindy Dugalecki, she wrote The Hand That Holds the Quill. This play opens, as you heard, Thursday night. Chris Purcell composed the music. There's so much more. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.